All right. Hello. Welcome to episode 2 of our SciChat podcast. I'm your host, Fata Kay, and today our guest is Dr. Jack Horn from the biology department.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
No problem. So, again, just with all of these episodes, we're bringing on our guest. We're just asking them about their career in STEM and how they got to the place they currently are at. Which undergrad institution did you go to, and have you always decided that you liked biology, or what sparked that interest initially?
Yeah, definitely. So I went to two undergrads. I went to my first 2 years of undergrads at State University of New York in Potsdam, and then I transferred to University of Florida in Gainesville. And I went and had already declared my major before even my first day of classes at Potsdam. I had taken a college-level biology intro course in high school, and so was very much interested in biology. The reason I switched to Florida is my parents moved from New York down to Georgia, and I didn't want to go to University of Georgia, so I went to University of Florida, who had a really good zoology department. And so I was a zoology major at Florida, and I graduated from there.
So would you say that you're more drawn to the animal side or the cellular side? Was it that particular organism, or was it just not organism, because you just said zoology, but is it the love of animals? Is it the love of animal processes, the cells? Could you...
Yeah, so it changed, actually. So as an undergrad, I was interested in all sorts of biology, but, you know, did some courses that did a little bit of field work, and I became interested in that. I thought that was cool. But then when I finished my degree, I was kind of looking around for stuff to do, and worked at the National Marine Fisheries Service on Long Island for a little bit, interviewing fishermen. That was kind of cool. But ended up getting a job at BU Medical Center, Boston University Medical Center, working in a lab as a lab technician. And in that process, we were working on neutrophil function. And I got really interested in cell biology and biochemistry. And so this was already after undergrad. And so I took biochemistry. I hadn't actually taken any cell biology or biochemistry as an undergrad, and became really interested in looking at that, and especially mechanisms of signal transduction. And so from there, I was at BU for a little more than a year. Then I went to Stanford University and worked as a technician there in another lab, actually a guy named Lubert Stryer, who had written the biochemistry textbook, so he was kind of famous in that way. So I worked at Stanford for 2 years, and through all of that, became really interested in cell biology, and then applied to graduate school in cell biology departments and ended up going to Duke University.
It sounds like you took a little bit of time to decide what you loved before you did grad school. What are the differences in doing the field work and doing the lab work with the cells? Which would you say is more enjoyable, and why? And why did you ultimately decide on grad school after going through all of those different lab work processes?
Yeah, so, you know, I only did a little bit of field work, so I wouldn't say I'm the best judge of everything, but when I started working in the lab and doing research, that was the first research I had ever done. So back in the olden days, when I was back in undergrad, it was hard to find opportunities to get into a research lab as an undergrad. These days, you know, we've realized that that's such an important experience that we find more opportunities, but so I never really did any real research until after undergrad. And when I did that, I became super interested in research. And that research was on basically cell biology and signal transduction research. And so I became very interested in that field through research. And that's why I decided to, I was already thinking of applying to grad school, but that sort of cinched it, because I really wanted to do research. And I kind of knew the general areas that I wanted to do it in.
So just for the viewers, your path was undergrad. You had your two different universities, a little bit of research. grad school, postdoc, and then a few other jobs. So we can hop back into the grad school portion, but if you maybe wanted to talk about the different jobs that you've held, aside from being a professor, that would be maybe interesting to our viewers, or also interesting to me, because I'd like to hear about that, especially more about the paper editing job with Nature.
Right. So, yeah, so I have a little bit of a different, you know, path, but, you know, when people say that it's not the normal path, I mean, I don't think there is really a normal path anymore. I think everyone finds different opportunities and changes things around. Not anyone stays, certainly don't stay within the same field most of the time. So I think being prepared for change is probably the best preparation.
I think in you saying that also, it's very hard to escape that mindset of a path, just going to like through K through 12 and then going to college. It's usually a set amount of years, and I'm putting air quotations around that because you're supposed to do undergrad in 4 years. You're supposed to. And I don't know, other than the curriculum where it's set, that you have to do this, but it's really okay to take your time. And sometimes taking your time helps you figure out the next move, right?
Absolutely. So, I did do my undergrad in 4 years, but then I worked in a lab and that totally changed my path. And so then I went to grad school at Duke and did it in cell biology and loved that. And then I did two postdocs. I did one postdoc in London at the National Institutes for Medical Research. And that was a kind of continuation of some of the research I had been doing as a grad student. But then as a postdoc, I really wanted to switch fields a little bit. I had been kind of a cell biologist working on calcium-based signal transduction. But as a grad student, I really wanted to start looking at the cell biology of development of the brain as a postdoc, I'm sorry. So my second postdoc, which was the main one, was working in developmental biology, looking at how the brain develops in Xenopus frogs. And so I was kind of applying some of my knowledge of cell biology, but now looking in the development of neurons and how they grow and form synapses and things like that.
How would you say, since you did that shift, how would you say your acquisition of knowledge changed? Was it still, I'm going to read all of the papers I can? Or did you have to shift processes a little bit to grasp that information?
No, the process is similar, but it's definitely harder to switch fields than to stay in the same field. And when you start looking for jobs, people like that you've done different things. I think it shows that you're better at handling different topics. I think most people switch fields, and sometimes it's sometimes encouraged to switch fields between grad school and postdoc. So switching fields is hard. You know, it definitely requires you to read a little bit more and figure out a new field. But I think that's some of the fun of science is figuring it out. You know, because I wasn't an expert, I had to go, all right, what the hell's going on here? So that was a good process. And that actually became very useful in my next job. So after I'd been at Caltech for about a year and a half, doing my postdoc in developmental neurobiology, I then was talking to a friend from grad school, and she was an editor at Nature. And there was a position at one of the Nature journals called Nature Neuroscience. It was supposed to be just a 3-month position for someone on maternity leave. And my friend was telling me about the job, and I thought it was really interesting. So I applied for it. My postdoc advisor said that was fine and got the job. So then I moved to New York and became an editor at Nature Neuroscience. And instead of being 3 months, or maybe it was supposed to be 6 months, I can't remember now. But anyway, I stayed 5 years at Nature. So 3 years at Nature Neuroscience, and then I switched to another journal called Nature Cell Biology. And so that was a really great experience in getting to know a lot of the cutting edge research that was going on, you know, being able to talk with, you know, the leaders in the world for their areas of research. And the job, although as you're called an editor, it wasn't editing writing per se, it was more managing the peer review process. And so my job was really to decide which manuscripts get reviewed and then to make decisions on whether those get rejected or accepted based on reviews. So that's, I was an editor in that sense. I wasn't a writing editor, although we did write pieces for the journal, editorials and little news things. And so I became a much better writer in those 5 years. But the exciting part of the job, and also the difficult part of the job, was reading a lot of different science. So during that 5 years, I would read, 10 plus new research papers every week. And I had to read them to the extent where I was making decisions about them. So it was pretty, scientifically involved. And so that's a lot of different areas of research, a lot of different papers. And so I was no longer an expert in one little field, but I became conversant in a lot of fields. And that was intellectually really exciting, I thought.
That sounds great. And in reading those papers, so it sounds like you were the gatekeeper, or a little bit of a gatekeeper. Were there other people in your position? Was it just about three yeses and a no? Or how did that process work out?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Nature, we got way more papers than we could publish. So we had to be selective. We received about 10 times as many papers as we could publish. So we had to reject, in the end, 90% of what we got, because we just didn't have room to publish it. So we had to pick the 10 best, the best 10%. And so the first cut, which was a large cut, like 70%, we rejected without review. And those were based on the editor's decision. So it wasn't just my decision alone. There was, at Nature Neuroscience, there was 5 editors. And one person would be the lead for a particular manuscript, but then we would discuss those decisions as an editorial board and come up with whether we thought this was a big enough advance to make it into the journal. So we weren't necessarily making a decision at that first step of whether the science was correct, right? We were relying on our expert reviewers to do that. But we were making a decision on whether this represented a big enough advance in the field such that it should be within that 10% of the papers that we publish. So that was that first cut. And then the second cut was after peer review. And so in peer review, we normally have 3 reviewers, and those would be experts in the field, and then we would make a decision based on their reviews. But it wasn't a vote, right? The reviews aren't like 2 yeses and a no or something like that. It was really looking at what they said about the paper and what their expertise was. So we might have different reviewers with different expertise. And if, if the genetics reviewer said the genetics are terrible, but the cell biology reviewer said, oh, the genetics are fine, we would go with the person whose field it was. So the decisions are sometimes more complex than they seem at face value, because we know more information. We know who the reviewer is and what their expertise is. So it was a very interesting process. You get to have a lot of people that are upset about those decisions. So it was also at times a stressful process, but intellectually challenging the whole time.
And you mentioned that throughout this entire process, your writing got better. What level of communication would you say is the best? And how did you find that balance? I'll explain with more words. So should you explain your science in such a way that people in the field can figure out, or people field adjacent with a little bit of research can figure out? Or should you put as much information as you can where the lay person just on the street can figure that out? Or is there a happy medium or a balance? Is there an art to writing scientific papers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the most important thing is consider your audience. So what's the audience for this particular thing that you're writing? If it's a research paper if it's a peer-reviewed research paper, the audience are mostly going to be people in the field or in adjacent fields that have an idea of what's going on. So you don't have to spend all the time explaining all the background there. However, you still want to be quite clear. And so the way that I became a better writer was organizing thoughts and making clearer, writing statements. But oftentimes we're also writing for a general science audience. So the news pieces that we write were about advances in a field that maybe it wasn't your particular field, but an adjacent field. And so there, you know, you want to have more of the background, more context. And then we would also write things like press releases where clearly you have to have it written for someone who's not a scientist. And so you would write those different things at different levels based on your audience. So it's always important to keep in mind when you're writing, you know, who is it that I'm talking to here? Do they know, you know, do they know what DNA is? Do they know how genes are expressed? You know, there's all different levels depending on what the piece is that you're writing.
That's definitely a great answer. Thanks for spelling that out. So to condense that, I suppose it's knowing your audience, and it depends on the medium that you're writing for. Cutting back to it was a postdoc in London that you did. How was there a culture shock there? What were the differences? Lab culture in the US versus lab culture in London. Maybe you can explain or give us some more information or intel. Are the setups different? Things of that nature.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so I was at you know, been in a lot of places, but I was a grad student at Duke. I was a postdoc at Caltech, and I was a postdoc in London at the National Institute for Medical Research. And there's a lot of similarities there. All of those places were very good labs, and there was high expectations on productivity and things like that at all those places. Now, there was a slightly different culture in England, and I think that probably could be extrapolated to Europe, where I think there's a little bit more of a consideration of work-life balance in England there seemed to be where I was. And even though it's a very good place and some great scientists, people would make sure that they had, you know, time to spend with families and things like that. So there was a little less of me working late on weekends in London as compared to when I was at Duke. But of course, at Duke, I was a grad student. A lot of the late nights were because I wasn't as efficient as I should have been. But yeah, I think there is a slight difference of cultures in between America and Europe. And I haven't done any research in Asia, but I expect that there are, you know, some differences there as well. So it's always important to keep in mind what the culture is. And that's actually one of the fun things about going somewhere else is to get to experience that different way of life.
Did it just happen that you ended up in London based on the topic and what you applied for, or were you seeking that out? And also, in terms of finding postdocs and other opportunities, what helped you out more, just sending out multiple applications, sending out emails directly to those lab coordinators or advisors, or strict networking and meeting as many people as you could?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the postdoc I did in London was someone in the same field that I was as a grad student. So he's someone that I knew from conferences, and I had done something that could have been useful in his lab. So I contacted him directly. And the reason I went to London was I had already planned the Caltech postdoc, but there was a delay. There was like a year where there wasn't space in the Caltech lab because someone was still there. And so I needed a year to do something else. And so that's when I contacted the guy in London and said, hey, you know, I can come work on this little project for a year and it might help your lab and it would help me out. And so that was strictly by knowing someone in the field. And my postdoc at Caltech was someone that I didn't necessarily know, but I knew of his research, and I, you know, knew of, you know, he had come to give talks at Duke, and so I'd kind of known people who knew him, and so I made contacts through that. And so in both cases, I directly contacted the person whose lab I wanted to work in, and so I didn't send out a lot of, I did send letters to a couple other labs, but aligning postdocs a lot of the times is based on, you know, maybe not just your advisor contacting other people, but other people within the department or at the university are usually great resources for identifying. And, you know, it's also dependent on which field you're interested in. You can kind of know which labs are doing things that you're interested in, And you can also take into consideration where they are. You know, a postdoc is a good chance to go somewhere different. And, you know, that you can get to a place at the same time as finding a great, you know, lab.
How important would you say are conferences in that process of networking also?
Yeah, conferences are totally key, especially as a grad student. You want to go to conferences and present your work to people in the field. So that, I think, is a great way to make, you know, contacts, but also just to become a scientist. I mean, presenting your work is and being critically evaluated by people who know what they're talking about. So if you give a talk in your department, the people in your lab know what's good and what's bad. And the people in the department in general would, but you're not going to get 10 experts in that field talking to you in your talks on campus. If you go to a conference that's in your field, they're going to be the 10 best people in that area. And so getting their feedback directly is invaluable. I mean, I think presenting at conferences is critical to becoming a better scientist.
Okay, so there's undergrad, there's internships, there are postdocs, there is just hopping into both industry and academia. How would you say that you would potentially avoid burnout, or is burnout inevitable? Or would you say that it's definitely key to maybe have outside hobbies to kind of tend to your mental health or things of that nature, just to keep moving along within the sciences?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. So I think you really do want to maintain a work-life balance that is appropriate for you. I mean, that's a decision that you have to make on a personal level. And, you know, there's times where you're going to work more than you probably would have planned. You know, as a grad student, when things aren't working, sometimes you're going to work more. But, you know, you want to keep in perspective that balance. So I would try to maintain that. Always think about that in sort of the longer term. As far as where you are, whether it's academia, industry, whichever, you know, thing you're pursuing at the time, I think the most important is what are your interests, you know. So if you're pursuing something that you're interested in, it's going to be a better job than if you're just following a path based on what seems to be the next obvious step. So I think you want to follow your passions and follow your interests. And in science, you know, that's one of the great things about being a scientist is that you really are allowed to pursue your interests, your individual interests, in a very in-depth way. So don't give that up. You know, continue to pursue what you think is important.
In terms of acquiring funding and going about getting your projects funded or having resources to complete your project, how much of that in your career was grant writing or already in the lab while you were recruited or on you?
Yeah, so as a grad student, typically where you want to make sure you know where you're applying and what sort of funding is available there and what are the responsibilities required for that. So that's kind of a decision that's made before you get there. That's a decision on a more university basis. As a postdoc, that's going to be lab dependent. You know, I always wrote postdoc grants, and you know, I didn't have one for maybe my first year at Caltech, but then I did get it in the second round and things like that. So postdocs, I think you want to try to get your funding. Not only does that help your PI, but that also gives you a little more flexibility in what you're going to do. And that writing process is very good. If you continue to go on and stay in academia, then, you know, writing grants is going to be a big part of your funding. And so it's a good way to get used to that process. And you know, getting grants, a lot of it is how well you are at writing them and how good of a writer you are. So when I took my first faculty job at Pace University, you know, I had taken that about a year after I left being an editor. So I had had this 5 years of being an editor. And so in some ways that was bad because I hadn't done a lot of experiments in those 5 years. So I was coming back into research with a little bit of a break. But I became a much better writer, both just as writing, but also from a scientific perspective, just from knowing a lot more science. And so I got my first grant from the NIH funded on the first try. And I think a lot of that had to do with that it was a well-written grant that was concise and made its point. And so writing is the writing of it is an important part. I think it helps your funding, being able to write the grant well.
And with the Nature job, you said you learned to write better overall. Are there still any basic tactics that you use to write, like making bullet points, writing outlines? How do you approach starting a paper from scratch, just the bones?
Yeah, so writing is editing. So everyone says that, or a lot of people say that, and that's totally true. So I don't think it matters how you start. What matters is how you finish. And so get the first draft done, but then edit that draft multiple times. So that's going to be where good writing comes from. It's not from having, you know, maybe the perfect sentences come out of the first draft. It's going to be from spending the time and fixing things as you go along. And that's the only way you learn. And so the reason I learned as an editor at Nature was because I had other editors edit my writing. And so that was, you know, probably the most I'd ever been edited. And I was edited heavily. You know, the first piece that I wrote for Nature Neuroscience and editorial, you know, that what was published and what I originally wrote, I don't think there was any resemblance of the two. So you know, I had never been so critically edited before. And that was the reason I became a better writer, because people spent the time to say, you know, this is terrible. You got to change this and that. And, you know, and having someone help you and edit your work is probably the best approach.
How did that feel, though, at first? Did you just get used to a lot of comments? Because sometimes seeing a sea of red all over your paper, you can take it a little bit harshly, more harshly than it's meant.
Absolutely. I mean, it was completely shocking when it first happened. And I was probably depressed for a while, but after a while, you know, that was the process. And it happened, you know, I would in turn edit, you know, the head editor's pieces as well. So, you know, it was a process that everyone knew was happening. And there were some very good writers, you know, better writers than I were. And so you were quite receptive to being edited. After a while, it just became the norm.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I hope the ears that reach, that's helpful to someone. So don't give up in your writing process. You just have to push through it. Were there any fun trips that you got to take or any really cool lab techniques that you got to learn? What's your favorite laboratory technique to just apply, like just have applied, just sciences and all?
So my postdoc at Caltech was like being in Disney World. So I was in Scott Fraser's lab, and he was a leader in microscopy. He was on the board of Zeiss. He was a physicist by original training. And so in our lab, we had something like 6 confocal microscopes and I think 3 2-photon microscopes and an MRI built for looking at embryology. So we had just unbelievable technology to work with. And so my favorite thing is looking at imaging in live animals, watching developmental processes go by using fluorescence. So that I think is really cool. The fact that we can see things as they happen and then do genetic manipulation, see how that affects that. That's what I think is really cool.
That's definitely great to hear. What would you say to students who are maybe intimidated by some of those processes? Because I know it can be different when you are taking tests or thinking about processes that aren't exactly tangible to others. So you can go outside, you can directly touch plants, you can't directly see those cells, you can't directly see the cellular processes going on in organisms. How would you tell or encourage people to get over that.
Yeah, so, well, a lot of that fluorescence microscopy, you can see a lot of those things actually going on, and that's one of the things that I like about it is even at the molecular level, you can see there are techniques for looking at interactions of proteins like fluorescence energy transfer and things like that. So there are ways that we can see things, but I really like the idea that we're looking at things that are not theoretical. So even though we're looking at molecular interactions, it's still something interacting with something else. So there's still, to me, conceptually, an easy way to visualize that. Even though I might not be looking at the molecule myself, it's something that you can think about in a really real sense. So even though it's things that are small in size, the interactions are still, you know, something easily visualized. And so that's the way that I think about cell biology, molecular biology, is that, you know, it's things interacting with other things. So that's how I tend to keep it straight, is by, you know, visualizing those things, because they're real things. You know, you can draw a picture of how this works. And so that I think helps me. Whereas there are some fields where it's you can't visualize, and there's, you know, great new areas of biology where you can't, like, see things on your own because it's too much data all at once. But I like the molecular side because it is things interacting with other things.
And you can kind of map that out in your brain, and also, as you said, see it through those high-powered microscopes.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that rounds out our episode. Thank you, Dr. Jack Horn, for being our guest today. And I hope some of you could get a glimpse into the world of Dr. Horn and how he got to this place as being a professor. Any last words or last takes?
My last take is that science is great because it allows you to pursue things on your own and learn things that no one else knows.
All right. Thank you so much.